I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from HBO Films, presenting Tsunami, The Aftermath, a two-part miniseries. Part 2 premieres Sunday, December 17th at 8 p.m., 7 Central, on HBO. And from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Marty Moss-Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. The Fair Housing Act was passed back in 1968 and it outlawed discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, disability, familial status, and national origin when it came to buying or renting housing. Now, almost 40 years later, many, if not most, neighborhoods and communities in this country are still largely segregated. This has persisted, even though the country is a much more racially and ethnically diverse place than it was back in the 1960s. My guest, sociologist Camille Zabrinsky-Charles, has used a city she used to live in, Los Angeles, to explore the connection between racial attitudes and the racial makeup of neighborhoods. She found that segregation often fosters mistrust, reinforces stereotypes, and adds to racial tension. Her book, which is based on surveys and focus groups, is called Won't You Be My Neighbor? She's an associate professor of sociology and faculty associate director of the Center for Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Camille Charles, nice to have you back. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And I actually want to begin where your book begins. And this is your own description of growing up in a neighborhood in Ventura, California. It was you and your mom as what, the lone black family in the neighborhood?
Yes. It was initially both my parents and I. But my mother is African American, my father's white, and my parents divorced when I was five or so. And once my father moved out, yeah, we were the only people of color for miles. In fact, at one point, the police told my mom that our house was a little red pushpin on their map, not because they thought we were going to cause any trouble, but more because they were concerned that somebody might cause trouble for us.
And did anyone cause trouble for you in that sort of overt, direct confrontational way?
No. I mean, it was a, you know, it was a very nice middle-class neighborhood. You know, one of the things that I talk about is that it wasn't until I sort of had my own kids and started to understand what, you know, the dynamics of play dates and birthday party invitations and all of those kinds of things that I started to think about how my own experience might have been different had I been white. Or, you know, had I lived in a neighborhood that had more people like me in it. So that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't even so much that people ignored me. It was a sense that I never really quite fit completely in. That sometimes kids weren't available to play. My sense is that I didn't get as many invitations for birthday parties and sleepovers and those kinds of things. I mean, I certainly did. I also said that I integrated my elementary school.
Exactly, you were the first black child to attend that school.
Right, and all of my school-related issues involved race, so that it was about either being called names that were racially motivated, or about, I think, teachers having different sets of expectations for me, and that I didn't fit those expectations.
And is this more in retrospect, as you look back on growing up in this neighborhood, where you began to understand the kinds of ways that you were treated and seeing a racial component in that?
Some of it I knew at the time. My father is a sociologist by training as well. And he often used sociology to help me understand what was going on. So, you know, obviously when I was called names, it was clear that it was about race, but it was also explained that, you know, people get angry and they go for the thing that's most hurtful. But even in terms of sort of times that I'd get in trouble at school, you know, I was always ahead of everybody else. And so I'd get bored and then I'd start talking and then I'd get in trouble. And so, you know, my dad would use sociology quite a bit to help me understand that. My mom also grew up in the segregated South, and so she could also help me to understand it. So some of it I understood in the moment, But there are other things that were more subtle.
But you couldn't say you lived in an integrated neighborhood. I mean, an integrated neighborhood that has one black family
right.
is not necessarily integrated.
No, no. And not. I mean, it was that stereotypic middle-class white neighborhood. So everybody was white. It was largely two-parent families with kids or retired couples. You know, there was a family that owned the local Baskin-Robbins. There was another family that owned the camera store. You know, so by no stretch of the imagination was it integrated in any way.
Your book really looks at Los Angeles, a place that you have lived in before you moved to Philadelphia. Why do you think that was a good city to begin to explore some of these racial attitudes and also racial preferences and racial neighborhoods?
Well, I think even as a kid, you know, my grandparents lived in Los Angeles, my paternal grandparents. And then my mom and a friend of hers used to sometimes throw us in the car and go to LA to get barbecue. So I knew Los Angeles, even as a kid, as this really cool place with lots of different kinds of people, and that certainly there were more people there who looked like me. But there were more of lots of different kinds of people. It just wasn't the same homogeneous community that I grew up in. So, you know, Los Angeles for me was always this kind of mecca. But when I moved to Los Angeles and actually lived there as an adult, first of all, and it was no longer the Disneyland fantasy, you know, I started to notice things that, yes, there are lots of different kinds of people there and lots of great food and all of those things, but that they don't live in the same communities, that you had to say, well, I want, you know, good Mexican food, so I'm going to drive over here, or I want good soul food, so I've got to go across, you know, LA over to here. And so, you know, little by little, that fantasy that I had about LA got kind of chipped away at. And again, it becomes a good place to study because it does have all of the groups there. It is a top destination for immigrants. So the other thing is that quite often we say that what happens to LA will ultimately happen to the rest of the country.
As it kind of goes across the country
from
west to east.
Exactly.
But wouldn't you say, just even from your observations of a lot of cities, including this city, Philadelphia, that yes, it's diverse, you walk the streets, you see many different kinds, many different colors of people, but when you begin to explore neighborhoods, they're largely racially homogeneous.
Yes. Yes. I mean, Philadelphia is one of the 29 hyper-segregated cities in the country. So, you know, at this point, there aren't enough blacks and Latinos, even though those populations have skyrocketed in, you know, between the 90 and 2000 census. There still aren't enough yet to know what the ultimate consequences of those increases will be. But certainly for African Americans, it's still a place where blacks are extremely segregated from whites.
One of the descriptions, or I guess explanations that I've heard, and it has to do with, well, you know, 40 years after the Fair Housing Act, people have a choice. People choose to live in largely segregated neighborhoods. What's your response to that?
Yeah, whether or not they choose to live in segregated neighborhoods, I think what is important is the motivation behind the choice. But the other thing about choices is that any group's choices will be constrained by the preferences of another group, so that nobody really has free rein to live in their ultimate ideal neighborhood. And some groups' preferences are constrained more than others, and certainly minority groups, groups who are disadvantaged either by smaller numbers, but also by lower socioeconomic status, a history of negative stereotypes and those kinds of things, their choices are going to be constrained more than the dominant groups who tend to be larger in number, better off financially. And again, they're the ones with the favorable images.
Well, and what you found is the kind of hierarchy of preferences. And at the top of the heap are whites.
Right.
At the bottom of the heap are African Americans. When it comes to this racial preference, help us understand, first of all, where racial preference comes from and then how it plays out in that racial kind of way. I mean, how do people decide or think or believe, you know, that whites are here and blacks are there?
Well, I mean, I think that particular dichotomy is part of our history, right? We had to justify the enslavement of millions of Africans, and we justified that at the time by claiming that they were, that Africans were less than human, that they couldn't make it on their own, that basically we needed to enslave Africans because they were savages. And really, all of the stereotypes from about African Americans have evolved out of that initial contact. Once we reached a point where we could no longer justify the biological inferiority, we moved to what we do currently, which is more of a cultural inferiority. That, you know, so that if there aren't as many African Americans graduating from college, or they have a higher dropout rate, well, they must not value education the way that whites do. Mm. If they have higher rates of unemployment, they don't value self-sufficiency in the same way. And so what happens instead of identifying them as biologically inferior, we've moved to cultural inferiority, and those stereotypes have persisted. One of the things that I think we thought was that as new groups come in...
I wanted to ask you about that.
You know, typically when a new group comes in, whatever group had been at the bottom moves up a notch.
Right.
And to a large extent, that doesn't seem to be happening for African Americans.
So what that means is that when foreigners, broadly speaking, move to this country, they also sort of buy into these racial preferences, this racial hierarchy.
Right. Right. So there are two things going on. I think with the globalization of media, foreigners are seeing our negative depictions of African Americans. So they see an absence of African Americans on sitcoms or other entertainment television programs that are transmitted that would show blacks in positive roles. But they also see our news coverage, which often depicts African Americans in a negative light. And so that was not present, right, before we had globalized media. If we had negative images of the Irish or of Eastern Europeans, that didn't get transmitted all over the globe, so that any newcomer that came in also already had those preconceived ideas. The second thing, though, is that new groups are coming in to improve their own lives economically quite often. And one of the things that happens is that I think they, you know, they look around and they learn the lay of the land, and they internalize the racial ideology that we have lived with all along, because, you know, the results from all of the research that I've done on Latino and Asians' racial attitudes shows that they think very similarly, but that for Latinos in particular, it takes about 5 years for their negative attitudes to translate into their behaviors toward African Americans.
And one of the things I think you say, and we're almost up on a break here, but and I hope I read it right, was again looking at this hierarchy, which is just a construct. Is you got whites, then Asians, then Hispanics, then African Americans from that,
right?
And these are the kind of embedded racial attitudes that define a lot of interactions, decision making.
Right, right. So, and there's some variation, you know, depending on which group you're looking at. So if you're looking at African Americans' preferences, they prefer whites first, then Latinos, then Asians. Because in LA in particular, there's a lot of friction between the Asian community and the black community. But otherwise, yeah, it's very consistent across groups that whites are the most favored groups, that Asians would come second, followed by Latinos and then African-Americans.
Well, I'll tell you what, we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking with sociologist Camille Zabrinsky-Charles about some of the findings in her new book. It's called Won't You Be My Neighbor, and it's subtitled Race, Class, and Residence in Los Angeles, a place she used to live. She now lives in Philadelphia, teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. Much more after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Cardiovascular Center at the Chester County Hospital supports WHYY. Just as we're a partner in cardiac surgery with Cleveland Clinic, we want our patients to be partners in care with us. To help you get the facts you need, our website now features important information about quality of care, patient satisfaction, and more. Located in Westchester, Pennsylvania, and online at 866drheart.com, the Cardiovascular Center is part of the health network of the Chester County Hospital. Beyond good care.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember the late clarinetist and soprano saxophonist Kenny DeVern and listen back to a performance and interview he recorded on our show. DeVern died Tuesday. Also, the songwriting team behind the Broadway musical Avenue Q, Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Hyman shook his head in defiance.
I want to be Judah Maccabee.
He wasn't going to be some schlub in a toga.
Nope. Hyman Klein would be the Maccabee of Miami Beach. Join Susan Stamberg and Murray Horowitz for an hour of stories celebrating the Hanukkah season. That's Hanukkah Lights 2006 from NPR.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking today on the show with sociologist Camille Zabrinsky-Charles, and she teaches in the department of the Center for Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She's a professor there, also a sociologist, and she's written a new book called Won't You Be My Neighbor, and it's subtitled Race, Class, and Residence in Los Angeles. Yes, we are here in Philadelphia, but many of the findings in this book can apply to many communities across the country. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, let's take the second part of your subtitle, class. When you throw class into the mix, does that change racial preferences, racial prejudices, the kinds of thinking and even decision-making that people make?
No.
Interesting.
And that, you know, that was quite startling, actually, because a lot of what we thought was that, you know, increasing education, for example, would improve people's racial attitudes. You know, there's a little bit of movement, but really when you start talking about who you want to live around, education, income had nothing to do with our preferences. Mm. And this was especially true among whites, where clearly it was the other racial attitudes. It was levels of prejudice. It was feeling that minority groups pose a competitive threat to economic and political power. You know, it was not, however, ethnocentrism.
Hmm. So, meaning what?
Meaning that there's this common idea that birds of a feather flock together and that we have segregated neighbors because we just like to live around people like ourselves. And the interesting thing is that you could think about that in a lot of ways. That could mean that we want to live around other people who share our religion. It could mean we want to live around other people who share our social class status or even our occupation. However, because we're a country that has been organized around race all along, we have taken that to mean that we have racially segregated neighborhoods because whites like to live around whites and blacks like to live around blacks. And it's not about disliking one another. It's just about liking people like us. And that turns out to have no value at all in understanding whites' preferences with African-Americans actually. A moderate amount of that feeling actually increases their preferences for integration, which is consistent, I think, with the idea that to better the group, we really need to be moving out and being able to take advantage of all that society has to offer.
And that would be better schools.
It'd be better
cleaner
schools.
Neighborhoods, probably safer neighborhoods.
Yes.
All the things that come with a more middle class
right.
lifestyle.
All of the things that we sort of associate with middle class white right. suburban communities. But they also talk a lot about the importance for racial harmony. That if we're going to get along, we have to live around each other. They want their kids to learn how to get along with lots of different people. So they talk actually about both of those things.
But would it be fair to say that, and perhaps I'm thinking more of whites here, but well, let's make it whites, that many whites say they actually want to live in an integrated neighborhood, but they don't necessarily make the steps to make that happen? Is that I guess what I'm trying to get to, is there a disconnect between what people say mm-hmm. about the kind of racially integrated or racially or ethnically integrated neighborhood that they live in and the actual steps that they take to live in that kind of neighborhood?
Sometimes, but not always. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I find that those whites who express preferences for integration actually mm-hmm. do live in more integrated neighborhoods than those who don't express those preferences. One thing that may happen is that you'll have some whites who would really prefer even more integration than they experience, but they may not be able to find that ideal situation. They're probably going to fall back to the best, less integrated alternative. And so there lies part of the problem. And some of the reason they're not going to find that ideal is associated with market forces. We know that there's still quite a bit of discrimination in the real estate industry and in the lending industry. So, you know, choices are constrained in various ways.
But I'm curious, even based on your own experience and as a sociologist, do you believe in integration? I mean, believe that that is a goal for this country to have, you know, as Martin Luther King said, you know, blacks and whites living together.
Right. I think that if it can be done while preserving everybody's humanity and dignity, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked earlier about understanding what motivates people's preferences so that African Americans and Latinos and Asians all say they do want some critical mass of people who look like them in their neighborhoods. When you start to look at why that is, one of the things that stands out is that they are concerned about hostility from whites. Hmm. So they don't want integration if it means they're going to receive hostile treatment. And hostile treatment could be anything from the extreme of, you know, crosses burned in your yard or graffiti on your house. But it could also be those more subtle things that, you know, that I'm now sort of seeing in retrospect that I experienced in terms of the absence of play dates and party invitations and those kinds of things. Or just sort of being ignored in your neighborhood. So they don't want that.
Right.
And they are genuinely concerned about that, and that does motivate their preferences.
But did you find racial stereotyping of whites from African Americans, from Asian Americans, from Latinos, that they also carry their own bag of prejudices looking at the
yes.
larger white culture?
Absolutely. Again, though, there's something important about being a member of a subordinate group versus being a dominant group member, so that minority groups have all of those negative stereotypes, mm-hmm. but they understand that the way our country is structured, you still have to get along with them, and more importantly, you do still want to be moving in those circles. So they have the negative stereotypes, mm-hmm. but they don't impact their preferences the same way that it works for whites in thinking about minority groups.
I wonder, because it seems that maybe the lone place where you actually see integration in this country is the workplace. I mean, many workplaces, especially in cities, are a rather diverse place where you do have people working in many cases side by side. Sometimes there is a kind of a racial hierarchy, but at
right.
the same time, there are people that are getting to know each other and working together on projects. And
right.
do you see that as a kind of island of integration in this country? And I realize that's a kind of a broad statement.
Yeah.
But
it can go in a variety of directions, because I think part of the problem, again, is that if you see minorities, but they're only in or overwhelmingly in clerical positions, administrative support positions, facilities positions, janitorial or food service positions, even in your workplace, you may have casual conversation
right.
with those people, but I think it still reinforces the stereotype that that's where those people, I say that in quotes,
sure.
belong. So that when you look at people who have interviewed professional minorities, so, you know, partners or associates in law firms, for example, or other sort of executive positions, those individuals still talk a lot about, again, kind of being shunned for the golf game with the boss or the party at the boss's house, that they don't get the same kind of mentoring and grooming for upward mobility. And some of that turns out to be white executives just sort of being afraid, thinking they don't know what they would talk to these people about kinds of things.
If they were in a golf cart for 3 hours.
Exactly. So there's a lot of sort of misconception that somehow we want to talk about completely different things. Mm-hmm. But there's also a fear that they don't want to say the wrong thing and be misconstrued as a racist. And that turns out to be a big deal. There's some research showing that
that's interesting.
That whites actually get very anxious if they're forced into a situation where if they make the wrong move, they're going to look like they're racist, like moving a chair further away from someone who is African American.
So kind of a self-consciousness.
Yes,
then.
Yes, and it causes stress. So, I mean, it's a huge, complex issue.
Well, I'll tell you what, let me just quickly reintroduce you. We've got callers that want to join our conversation. And we are talking with sociologist Camille Zabrinsky-Charles. She's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. In fact, she's a professor, associate professor of sociology and a faculty associate director of the Center for Africana Studies. And that is at the University of Pennsylvania. And she's got a new book. It's called Won't You Be My Neighbor? And it's subtitled Race, Class, and Residence in Los Angeles. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's get Lorenzo from Germantown to join us. Lorenzo, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Listen,
good.
I have a question. I beg to differ with your guest today, because every time we talk about a race in America, or, you know, problems with the race in America, it seems like blacks are always the ones being chosen in this research. You know, Asians have racial problems with whites. Why isn't there ever any study? And I challenge your guest to do a study on the attitudes of white people who have come into this country and who have built this country on the backs on slave labor, and find out why they have created this attitude of division. I mean, blacks today have done enormous, have made enormous strides in America to develop their own businesses, to develop their own country clubs, develop their own way, because they realize now that this is how you do things in America. Nothing comes free, and nothing is going to go unchallenged. I'm just tired of every time there's a study or a health research, that blacks are always the guinea pigs for this research.
Well, let me just stop you there, Lorenzo, only because I'm not sure you've taken away from our guest research or even our conversation, I think, what she's talking about. But let me give her a chance to respond to
sure.
Your comments and
sure.
criticism. Go ahead, Camille.
I think the first thing is that we did interview whites, blacks, Latinos who are largely from Mexico and Central America, as well as Japanese, Chinese, and Koreans in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And even with the Asian population, about 80% of them were immigrants. So we interviewed in Korean, Mandarin, and Cantonese. And we looked at everybody's racial attitudes about everybody else. So it was actually quite complicated. And certainly, I think I just finished saying, actually, that all minority groups have negative attitudes about whites. Those attitudes have to do with the belief that whites see themselves as a little bit more superior, that they tend to discriminate against members of other groups. They're concerned about feelings of hostility. However, there's also a lot of group tension among minority groups. So, you know, Asians and African Americans in Los Angeles in particular don't get along that well. Latinos and African Americans get along a little bit better, but that's native-born Latinos. Foreign-born Latinos actually don't have great attitudes about African Americans, and again, that is important to the extent that we think about the first wave of immigration in our country, which was largely an immigration of whites, and their ability to sort of outgrow being stigmatized as newer groups came in. And what we're noticing is that isn't happening for African Americans, which is why, you know, we're still paying attention to this. They're not getting to move up in terms of that social hierarchy, in terms of groups who are viewed as, you know, good or not as good in one way or another. One of the other things is that indeed African Americans have made huge strides, and I, you know, I am the beneficiary of many of those strides. So that, you know, my mother benefited from the civil rights movement and is professionally employed. I grew up in middle-class neighborhoods. I went to good schools. I attended college. I went to a top graduate program. So, you know, and all of the blacks that I sort of work around have those same experiences. And, you know, I also live in Germantown. So I know that while there are plenty of blacks who are doing great, there are plenty who are still struggling. And even those African-Americans who are middle-class and affluent are not comparable to similarly situated whites. That's largely a function of wealth. So that if you look at the assets of African Americans and whites at any comparable level of education or professional occupation status, they don't have – whites have eight times the wealth on average that African Americans do.
And that would include a house. I mean, all the things that we
– Right. Houses, stocks, all of those kinds of things. One of the problems with segregation is that it impacts property values so that African Americans and Latinos were the only two groups who were negatively impacted by owning a home. So they lived in lower class neighborhoods if they owned their homes, where typically we think that owning a home means that we're going to do better.
And that that house improves in value, and then you make
exactly.
that step up. Lorenzo, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I almost hate to do this, but as you were talking, I was thinking about the number of illegal immigrants in this country, about 10, 12 million at this point. And you know, it's hard to sort of read the country's reaction to that. On the one hand, very dependent on their labor, but on the other hand, there's lots of negative things that have been said about these illegal immigrants. And I wonder if you've, when you were doing some of your surveys and studies, whether that thrown in the mix also it changes in any way the kind of racial beliefs, prejudices out there. And then we'll get back to our callers.
Sure. I do think that Latinos, in terms of racial stereotypes, they are penalized for the idea that some large number of them, meaning a majority of them, are undocumented.
Right.
And so increasingly, as immigration increases over time, we're seeing that whites' attitudes toward Latinos are about on par with their attitudes toward African Americans in terms of being negative, in terms of being viewed as welfare dependent or lazy or criminally inclined. The one difference is on the language piece, so that if you ask about their ability to speak English, whites don't think that Latinos speak English very well, but they see it as a cultural difference where when they say the same thing about African Americans, they're thinking about it differently.
Interesting. Let me get to Jim from Mount Airy to join us. Jim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to bring up one topic that I just didn't think was broached, and it just seems that there are some areas where the diversity and the richness of different cultures do blend together. I happen to live in an area called Mount Airy, and it's a beautiful place. It's a place where there's diversity of economics, there's a diversity of cultures, there's a diversity of orientations, and it's a place that I found people have gone out of their way to learn about other people's cultures and kind of be a little open to listening to where other people are coming from.
Well, Jim,
and I, believe me, I'm not taking anything away from what the speaker is saying. I know there's a lot of challenges out there.
Sure.
But there are places. And from what I understand, I'm not an original Mount Airian, I guess, but people made a real concerted effort to try and make Mount Airy as culturally sensitive and aware, and I think they've still done it. And if I understand, it's been about 30 years worth of this type of community.
Yeah, you know what, Jim, I got to just stop you there only because we're almost up on a break. Just a real quick response, if you could, Camille, then we'll pick it up after the break.
About 20% of neighborhoods in the U.S. are stably integrated, which means they've been integrated for about 20 years or more. Mount Airy, I believe, has actually been stably integrated for about 50 years. If you look at the entire community. However, I'm actually starting a big research project on Philadelphia, and I actually looked at Mount Airy, and as you move away from Germantown Avenue, it moves from black to white. So the entire neighborhood is integrated, but some places are more segregated than others.
Interesting. Jim, thanks for calling into Radio Times, and that's Camille Zabrinsky-Charles, our guest today on the show. We're talking about her new book called Won't You Be My Neighbor? Race, Class, and Residence in Los Angeles. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Celebrate the Jewish Festival of Lights with Leonard Nimoy and the Western Wind. Join us for a delightful and moving hour of songs sung by the Western Wind and holiday stories told by the inimitable Mr. Spock of Star Trek fame. It's Leonard Nimoy and the Western Wind in Hanukkah and Story and Song from PRI.
Monday night at 10 on WHYY.
Ho, ho, ho. I'm Chef Jim Coleman. Happy holidays. Don't worry, we'll get you and your elves on the right track. And cook your goose. I mean Christmas goose.
Goose is very deceptive. It looks huge, but there's very little meat on the breast. So you need to allow a pound of goose per person.
Plus the Barefoot Contessa, Graham Kerr, and much more. Tomorrow at noon on WHYY 91 FM.
Next time on Day to Day.
Ron Gompertz is Jewish, his wife a conservative Christian.
So what do they do when they get hungry for some of their traditional holiday treats?
We have falalala latkes, matzah pizza, gefilte goose is one of our favorite recipes. We couldn't do gefilte ham because that just wouldn't be kosher.
Merry Mazel Tov, some tips for celebrating Chrismica.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and our guest is Camille Charles. She's Associate Professor of Sociology, Faculty Associate Director of the Center for Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and the author of a new book, which is what we're talking about, called Won't You Be My Neighbor? It's subtitled Race, Class, and Residence in Los Angeles. I know you wanted to add something to the whole Germantown, Mount Airy discussion.
Yeah. I don't want to come off as, you know, implying that Mount Airy is a fraud, because it isn't. I think they do work very hard at maintaining diversity and tolerance and promoting that as one of the values of living in that community. And I think they're doing a very good job of that. I think, though, it's still important to understand that, again, as you move through the neighborhood from the sort of doubles and row houses to the quarter-acre lots with the free single-detached houses, that there is some segregation that occurs there. However, because they are in the same community, and I know there are common spaces, there's a co-op and there's a coffee house and other things, there is a lot more interaction that happens there, and that does make it a great place to live, and I think that it's a great asset to Philadelphia. The problem is that there aren't enough communities like that for all of the people who would like to live in those kinds of places, and that's expensive real estate. And so in terms of affordable housing for working class people, it's really not going to be an option.
Let me get Reggie from Overbrook to join us. Hi, Reggie. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And I want to thank you for a fascinating discussion this
morning.
Great.
Thank you so much.
I'm looking at it from a perspective that I'm an immigrant who spent a great deal of my formative years here. I'm an Ivy League graduate, professional, blah blah. And I think that what your guest is saying, a lot of it, despite what some previous callers have said, I find to ring true.
Hmm.
I think that the one thing that I've had to deal with in academia and in the professional world is isolation. I've been to corporate meetings where in two or three days of, several hundred people there, I saw one other person of color, and that was like on the last day of the meeting. And you do find that there are people who they don't really know how to talk to you.
No, that's right. Interesting.
They are afraid. But I just wanted to make one comment and have your guest, respond.
Go ahead,
my approach to it has been that I basically don't care what mores America puts on race, on residence, or anything. I think there are more and more people of color who do what they want, who live where they want, and they just don't care.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, Reggie. I appreciate you calling into Radio Times. What are your thoughts, Camille?
I think he's probably right, at least on a conscious level. I think that, in my own life, it eats away at you subtly. And so there are those sort of daily frustrations, and there's a lot of health research coming out that talks about how chronic stress has these negative health consequences, including type 2 diabetes and hypertension, mm-hmm. which run rampant in the Black community, for example. Living with racism, whether you're talking about the overt cross-burning kind of racism or just those daily small indignities, is a form of chronic stress. Living in underserved, segregated communities is a form of chronic stress. Mm. So from an inequality perspective, which is really where I come from with this, is that residential segregation has drastic negative consequences for the life chances of people who are constrained in their choices, so that it affects the kinds of schools you go to, it affects your social networks that get you access to jobs, it affects the likelihood that you're going to be stopped and detained by the police, whether you get taken to the station or taken home for loitering, for example. All of those things are implicated by where we live, or influenced by where we live, I should say. And so, you know, our ability to accumulate wealth will depend on where we own our home, not just that we own a home. So from an inequality perspective, I think these issues are still important. It's an unresolved part of sort of the civil rights movement. We often talk about residential segregation as the linchpin, because it's the one thing we haven't been able to get over, and that if we could address this issue, the educational issues may get better, because we don't have segregated, underserved inner city schools that are largely minority, while whites are fleeing to suburbs. Or, you know, in Philadelphia, I know there's we deal with private schools, whether they're parochial schools or Quaker schools or other forms of independent schools. But all of that has to do in many important ways with residential segregation, which was why I thought it was important from an inequality perspective. It also has to do with our ability to get along with one another. And so in terms of just living up to the American ideal that all men are created equal, that, you know, we all get along and those kinds of things, especially since we go out into the rest of the world saying that they should all get along, residential segregation keeps us from achieving those ideals.
Reggie, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And perhaps this is more prescriptive than you want to be, but you've described the sort of latent prejudices, deep-seated prejudices that really keep people apart. Is it just knowing somebody that begins to break down those prejudices? Is it that kind of experience? And is it, you know, sort of a great session for the country? You know, I mean, there was much talk during the Clinton administration that we'd all have sit down and get to know each other better.
Right.
It didn't really happen very well.
Right. You know, there's some research that suggests that people who grow up in integrated circumstances, which means they live in integrated neighborhoods and they attend integrated schools, have more tolerant racial attitudes as adults. They also have more integrated friendship circles as adults. They seek out more integrated settings as adults. But I don't think it helps to know one black person or one Latino or one Asian, you know, or for a black person who moves in black circles to know one white person, because what happens is what we call exceptionalism, so that one person isn't like those other people. The caller talked about being at an Ivy League university. Part of what happens is that the good minority students, and I'm
being
in quotations, the high achiever, the one that, you know, does everything right, the one that bucks the stereotype that we have of African American students is, wow, you're such a great student. You know, you write so well, you speak so well, you're not like those other students. That's not a compliment. And it's engaging in negative stereotypes so that a professor or another student's interaction with that one student just changes his or her beliefs about that one person, so that we do need to have more sustained contact. But it also has to occur among people who are of equal status and are working toward a common goal. So one of the nice things about West Mount Airy is that
in Philadelphia, you do have
people who are middle class and affluent, and they are working toward maintaining a diverse, tolerant community. They all share that goal, so that whatever complexities are involved and whatever problems may come up, they are dealing with each other as equals, and that does have benefits.
Reggie, thanks for the call. Let me get James from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I would just like to say to your guest, one, in terms of comments, the legal shackles only came off 42 years ago.
Yes.
So that's the yardstick that it should be measured by. Ray Suarez, I think I'm pronouncing his name.
Ray Suarez,
right?
Yeah.
Wrote a book about 3 or 4 years ago talking about housing and how it basically created segregation in this country after the Second World War, that blacks were not allowed to go into the various housing developments that was set up in this country.
Red
because
line.
Most people did not own houses in this country prior to the Second World War. The GI Bill made it possible. Now, the GI Bill, when Levitt towns and stuff like that were set up, they did not allow blacks in.
And now, James, can I just jump in here only because we got a lot of callers and I'm watching the clock and I know you've got
a
point.
But yeah, anyhow, in terms of her argument, how does she explain people like in Tennessee, Harold Ford, who only missed becoming a senator down there by 3% votes, or the Attorney General of the state of Georgia, who runs statewide, who wins, who has won two terms in Georgia, just different aspects. Even Bradley back in L.A. 30 years ago.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
How do you explain things like that in terms of attitudes not changing?
And I guess the idea being that in order to win, they had to get white votes.
Right. And then the other thing is, how do you explain people like Ken Chenault, who runs American Express, Dan O'Neill, who runs Merrill Lynch, or Richard Parson, who runs Time Warner, in terms of the corporate facet? How do you explain things like that?
James, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Camille.
Yeah. Again, I'm not denying in any way that African Americans have made great strides, you know, monumental strides. I mean, you left out Oprah Winfrey, Barack Obama, Johnson, who used to own BET.
Sure.
Okay, so there are many more prominent, extremely wealthy African Americans than there were, you know, even 20 years ago. Again, I could probably rent a big banquet room at a really nice hotel and get all of those people together and have some space left in that room. So the fact that we can single them out one by one is still problematic. And it's a double-edged sword because on the one hand, it's an indicator of great progress. On the other hand, they get pointed to and then we say, we're all done now. Everything is equal, and it's not. If we looked at the origins of those people, either they came from middle class families to start with, because there was a black elite, in the post slavery period, or they got, you know, they had opportunities made available to them. Middle class blacks were the biggest beneficiaries of affirmative action during the 70s and 80s. And so we would expect improvements from that class of African Americans. The problem is that we still have so many African Americans who are struggling to make ends meet. And, you know, I'm not talking about the never employed, standing on the corner kind of people. I'm talking about people who do work, but they don't make living wages or they don't have insurance. And so the minute something goes wrong, everything falls apart. They're never able to accumulate wealth. And again, I have to wonder what the wealth of wealthy African Americans would look like if they had been white to start with. You know, it might be Bill Gates kinds of affluence, or, you know, we don't have the same kind of old money in the black community that you have in the white community. And yes, it's only been 42 years, but we've made a lot of strides in other areas. This one has not changed all that much.
And what you're really focusing in on are these neighborhoods where they are, I guess, either working class or certainly African American, where people, because of the condition of those neighborhoods, can't get out. And your house doesn't increase in value,
exactly.
So you can't buy up.
Exactly. You can also just face more barriers in the you know, routine activity of trying to find housing. So that they've done studies on how much harder African Americans and actually Latinos and Asians in L.A. face the same kinds of barriers, Latinos in particular, in Los Angeles, that African Americans do. So that this is no longer just about African Americans. But it's not getting better as quickly as one would expect or as quickly as a lot of people seem to think.
I mean, it does speak to the power of class, I guess, too.
Yes, class is definitely important. But one of the other things that I wanted to be clear about is that while we've seen a lot of fundamental change in whites' attitudes in terms of principles of egalitarian, the majority of whites still adhere to negative stereotypes about minority groups, not just African Americans, and that those negative stereotypes do influence their housing decisions.
Let me get Eunice from Reading to join us. Eunice, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had maybe about three comments. I'll make them quick. I think the reason that black people have had hard time assimilating is because of their color. We've seen people of European background, the Irish, the Italian. You know, they come here after a while. You know, they're all white. Mm-hmm. You can't tell where they came from. So unless black people are able to do something about their color, I think it's as long as people have a negative attitude towards someone's color and there's nothing you can do about it, it's going to take a while. And in fact, the original slaves were white, currently the people occupying the Appalachian, and they assimilated, and that was the problem. That's why they thought of getting black people, because then you distinguish them.
Well, you know what, Eunice, and I know you had several other points to make, but we're almost out of time here, and I just wanted to give our guest a chance to respond. I mean, you can't do what she's obviously suggesting.
No, you can't.
Done.
But she has a good point, that visible African ancestry is a barrier, and that is related to our history in the U.S. If you look at what happens to Latinos, you know, that's an ethnic category. There are white Latinos and there are black Latinos. Black Latinos have the same kinds of problems that African Americans have. So by no means is there a universal Latino experience. Now, Asians are distinct in their appearance, but our attitudes about Asians have traditionally been positive. They're the model minority. They're smarter than everybody else. They work harder than everybody else. And that goes a long way toward assimilating. So I think it's actually the combination of the dark skin and the negative stereotypes that were developed. You know, we did pick physically obvious slaves to start with for a particular reason, but then we attached a negative set of attitudes to rationalize our treatment of that population, and all of that works together.
And you're saying we got a long way to go.
Yes.
But
there has been some remarkable progress, so that more whites are willing to live in integrated communities. Mm-hmm. Minorities are still interested, despite their concerns, in living in integrated communities. And we could actually have more than we see in reality in the U.S.
Let's end on that note. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank
and our
you.
Guest, you're welcome. Our guest has been Camille Zabrinsky-Charles, and we've been talking about her new book called Won't You Be My Neighbor? Race, Class, and Residence in Los Angeles. She's Associate Professor of Sociology, Faculty Associate Director of the Center for Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Sorry we couldn't get to all the callers, but go to our website, whyy.org/radiotimes. You can leave us an email and find out more about the program, including podcasts of the program. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.